Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chicago's Legal Latte, a series of podcasts brought to you by Lavelle Law Limited. Throughout this series, the attorneys from Lavelle Law will share their answers to questions about a variety of topics for individuals and small businesses. To participate in today's discussion, you can email us at podcast@lavellelaw.com.
In its simplest form, I think we can preview today's podcast topic by saying this: to avoid disagreements, have an agreement. Hi, this is Jim Mitchell, and today we're going to discuss the value of shareholder agreements and look at the types of companies that may need them. If you're a regular listener here, you know that our guests from Lavelle Law often stress how proper planning for a business entity can prevent a range of issues later. And I think that's exactly what we'll hear today as I welcome Attorney Jim Voigt back to our series. First of all, good afternoon, Jim. Nice to talk to you again.
Good talk to you, Jim.
You know, we'll get into some details here over the next quarter hour, and I'm sure you'll provide a great deal of information for us. But before we, you know, jump into that, just up front, what business entities are we talking about today? Is this corporations specifically, or really any business structure that would benefit from these?
What we're really talking about today specifically, and some of the details that we get into are going to be dealing with corporations, but whether you're a corporation, LLC, partnership, limited partnership, all of these concepts would apply. Some of the language might change. Like when I'm talking about stock, you'd actually be talking about a membership unit in an LLC, but the ideas are all the same.
Okay. All right. So shareholder agreement. I mean, I assume there's a nice, succinct legal definition of what that is. Why don't we start with that, and then we can kind of talk about why one might be a good idea.
Sure. Well, basically what a shareholder agreement is when the shareholders of a corporation get together and say, we're going to agree about how we do certain things here. And I've got a list that we'll go through in a minute of, you know, what some of those topics are. But basically what it is it's how do we plan on running this business? How do we plan on voting? How do we plan on handling money? Let's get all of that flushed out right now so that we don't end up arguing about it later.
Okay. And again, I'll throw one more quick question in here for you. You mentioned that as a logical place for what sounds like a new business entity. If there's a company that's been running for a while, is this something that can sort of be brought into the fact that, look, things aren't going well, let's create this now, or is it really something a company has to do up front?
No, it's good to do it up front because then you've sort of headed off problems before they had the chance to come up. But if there is a company out there that doesn't have a shareholder agreement, then yeah, you can do that at any time. And really, when you know, to answer the question of, you know, well, when should you do this? It's, you know, anytime you've got more than one shareholder, which is, you know, a lot of companies. And then it's typically before things are profitable, because the common misconception is, you know, I don't think we'll have any trouble. I don't think the business is going to fail, so we don't need a shareholder agreement. But in reality, what we're trying to do is having the fight when the company's worth $20 million. Everyone's fighting over, well, you said you would do this and you said you would do that, so I should get more of the pie and that sort of thing. So it's really the key is to get it in place when everyone still likes each other and before the company has become profitable.
Okay, excellent. So you mentioned different business entities could use it in different ways, different wording might occur, but are there certain elements that, you know, every shareholder agreement should really include to make it a good document, sort of standard boilerplate stuff?
Yeah, there are several issues that should be addressed, and as you and I kind of joked about in the lead-up before we went on the air today in the podcast, you know, my list of things to cover in a shareholder agreement is 7 pages long. That list is actually available. We'll send it to anybody that asks for it, and you can just send an email to podcast@lavellelaw.com, and we'll respond and give you that list. But what I've done is sort of hit the major highlights that really need to be addressed in detail, and just kind of stop me as we run short on time here.
Yeah, definitely start with the top ones here. Where would you
start?
Yeah,
one of the biggest questions is going to be how do profits get paid out? You know, typically speaking, they're going to be paid out pro rata, according to shares, and that's where people leave it. But then you have a huge open question of, well, wait a minute, when do we pay out profits? I mean, are we going to pile up some money here for future investment if we turn profitable? Are we going to issue these things monthly, you know, every penny that's available? So one of the big questions is going to be, let's control either A, let's put a formula in place that says, here's how we will pay out profits, or B, let's put a formula in place that says, here's how we'll decide in each situation how we pay out profits. Is it just a 50-50 vote, you know, the majority rules, or do we have to have, say, 75% of the shareholders say that it's time for a profit distribution? Does maybe just the president himself decide with no input from shareholders, that kind of thing? So let's figure out how are we going to pay out profits and when, because one of the great strategies to use if you have a shareholder dispute is to just cut off profits. And if you're the president and also a shareholder, you just raise your salary. And so it's a great leverage. Let's eliminate the opportunity to use that leverage. The next topic, and this is so important, and I just met with a client this morning about it that had literally no idea how to answer this question. Who is giving what in exchange for their shares? And the conversation I had this morning was very simple. Well, you know, I'm putting in a lot of sweat equity and I get 30%. And then this other guy is really knowledgeable in the field and he's helping us a lot and he gets 20%. And then we've got this other guy who's putting in $100,000 and he gets the remaining percentage. And I said, you know, it's ripe for controversy here because eventually at some point what we're going to fight about is, well, you know, you said you were going to put in sweat equity, but you really didn't do everything you said you were going to. So we don't feel like you really ever paid for your stock. And now that the company's worth $20 million, it's worth it for us to fight about this in court for 5 years, right? So what I asked them to do was I said, you know, you've put in sweat equity, but, you know, the sweat equity you've put in is the same thing you do for a living every day. And normally you bill your clients for it. So had you been billing this new startup company for all your work, what would it have cost? And that's the value of what you've put in. Let's be really specific and put some dollar amounts on things. Let's avoid vague statements of who got their stock in exchange for what. Let's get it right down to dollars. It's hard to do, but it's important to do.
Now, and then once – go ahead. Go ahead. Here. Because once you're talking about owning shares of stock, and I think one of the next things you're going to mention here is – you know, controlling that stock. If I'm one of those people putting the sweat equity in and I decide I've had enough, can I just turn around and sell that then? Is that something that should be covered?
Exactly right. One of the biggest topics you want to cover is, can you sell the stock or not, right? There are some securities implications for that in terms of securities laws, and that's way beyond the scope of this podcast. But just from a more practical perspective, if you're super best friend that you've known since third grade and you're going into business with and he's 50-50 with you, decides he wants to sell his stock to just some guy because he's short on cash, well, yeah, you're in business with that guy now, whether you like him or not. So we want to put some restrictions in place, one, to make things a little easier in terms of complying with securities laws, but two, we want to put some restrictions on what you can do to transfer that stock so that you don't end up just being in business with whoever you want. Another way that that commonly comes into play is one of your shareholders gets sued for collection or something, who knows what, that person wins their lawsuit and they say, okay, well, I'm going to take their property. I'll take a lien on their house. I'll take their car. Oh, and they've got this stock in ABC company. I'll go ahead and take that too. So now you're in business with somebody you never thought you would be. So restrictions on stock are super important.
Okay. What else are on the top of the list for us?
We also have, what is the purpose of owning your stock, right? You want to be able to vote. Well, in addition to just the ability to vote, we want to actually set out in a shareholder agreement who's going to be the president, who's going to be the secretary, vice president, who's going to be on the board of directors. We can actually write right into the shareholder agreement who is going to fill all of those positions. Now, a common objection people have is, well, what if we want to change that in 10 years? Well, that's fine. We can build that flexibility in there too. But we want to set it out at first for two reasons. One, it's nice to have that to no longer be an ambiguous question, right? So we're not fighting over who's going to, you know, vote for who in terms of what position. But two, if it's very common for two people going into business or eight people going into business together to have certain assumptions about who's going to be the president and who's going to be on the board of directors, but their assumptions are all different. My perspective is I want to flush that potential conflict out right now at the very beginning before there is, you know, bitterness and resentment and all of these things. Let's get everybody talking about that and figure out where we agree or disagree right from the start. And that's why we like to see board and officer appointments right there in the shareholder agreement.
Okay. Now, you also talked about, you know, how you handle profits and, you know, whether you, you know, take more salary or how you, I don't say play with the books, but how you adjust expenses versus profit and what that means to the shareholders. I assume then you also have to cover how the company will be valued, the way in which collectively you all agree what the current value of that company and therefore the shares of stock would be.
Exactly right. This is a really important question for two reasons. One, valuations of companies is a wide open target. It's very difficult to get two parties to agree on what method would be used. I think there's probably something like 20 different methods that you could use to value the company. the guy that wants the company to be valued at the smallest possible level will just say, well, I think we should just do income minus assets. We own $1 million worth of stuff. We owe $800,000 worth of debt, so the company is worth $200,000. The other guy says, no. Shouldn't we look at, why don't we look at the next 5 years of potential income and figure out what the company is worth that way? Any one of these, in theory, are potentially valid ways to value the company. Let's eliminate a two-year lawsuit just figuring out how we'll value the company and set a formula right in the shareholder agreement on how we're going to do that. And the question is, well, why does it matter? There's two ways that it could matter. One, what are we going to price shares at for new shareholders that come in down the line, if that's something we're thinking about? And two, if one of us were to pass away and the company is going to buy back our stock, which is something we usually recommend, what price are they going to pay to that? And that's an important question because, by its very nature, you're not there to argue about it anymore. So having everybody agree on the right method to use for valuing the company is important to add into the shareholder agreement.
With me today is a real champion of small business causes, Jim Voigt, and we're talking about shareholder agreements. Now, Jim, earlier you mentioned a case in which shares are exposed due to a lawsuit or other consequences. What else might potentially go wrong, or what would some of the unintended results of a shareholder agreement be that you really have to be careful of?
The biggest thing that we see go wrong is that all of the different shareholders that got together, like I said before, had all different understandings and assumptions about things that they all thought they agreed on, only to find out a couple of years later, after the company is profitable and busy, that they actually didn't agree. So the biggest thing is just unresolved issues that people didn't even know were there. And a great example of that is difficulty in determining who actually owns the company. Believe it or not, that seems like the simplest thing in the world, but I actually have a marketing piece that I produced. It was a real memo that I prepared for a client. I billed them almost 11 hours for it. And the purpose of that memo was us going through all of their corporate documents to try to figure out who owned what percentage of the company. At the end of the day, we couldn't figure it out. We just came up with the best possible argument that we could, but we literally were unable to determine who owned what percentage of the company. And I actually converted that to a marketing piece. I changed all the names in it and made it anonymous because, just to show people, this really, really does happen. The other big issue that we run into is, I hinted at it already a little bit, is sale of stock or loss of your stock to an undesirable party. Somebody, even in a simple divorce matter, you could end up having your business partner's wife being a common shareholder with you. And I don't think anybody, it's not that we don't necessarily like that person, but it certainly wasn't who we had planned to have voting on the board of directors and that sort of thing. So the main thing that we want to do with a shareholder agreement is avoid the fighting by bringing all these issues up in the forefront right now when everybody's still in a good mood and we're all looking forward instead of looking backwards with anger and resentment.
Yeah, we've got just about a minute left here, Jim, and I'm going to reach back to one of our previous discussions when you joined me, and we talked about the annual report and the process that a company needs to go through to file that. And I know frequently that touches on some of these things. Would parts of the shareholder agreement, things we've covered today, be something that would be reviewed in the annual meeting and perhaps updated or changed through that annual report that a corporation would file?
Sure. Well, not necessarily for the annual report. I mean, one of the things that would be controlled is the annual report tells the state, here's who our board of directors is, and here's who the officers of the corporation are. And that's something that would potentially be addressed in a good shareholder agreement. So to that extent, yes. To another extent, though, the shareholder agreement can also, set some of the rules about how that annual shareholders and board meeting would go. So that can be important in terms of what would be discussed. And I believe you may have, asked something about, is there anything in the shareholder agreement that might change from time to time with regards to that annual meeting? One of the common things that would change is every year our valuation method, quote unquote, is going to be every year at our shareholder meeting we agree on what the value of the company is, and if we don't agree, we just keep the one from last year. So that's something that might change. Keep in mind, though, an important point. Shareholder agreements are flexible because they can always be amended at any time. So you don't feel like you're locked in for 20 years because you signed something. But what you are is locked in. Your rights are locked in until everybody agrees that it's time to make a change.
Okay. Well, as always, great information from Jim Voigt. We appreciate him being here. Information, you can find Jim's profile and contact information at lavellelaw.com. And right there is also a place where you'll find a lot of our previous podcasts featuring Jim and some of his colleagues. So feel free to check that out. And we will look forward to having you back with us again next week as we tackle another topic here on Chicago's Legal Latte. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Chicago.